I'm reading the diary of a CEO, and in one of the studies, he quoted the average attention span has dropped from 10 seconds to 8 seconds, which is less than a goldfish. Apparently, goldfish has about 9 seconds of attention span. And there are a lot of people giving their advices, doing different hooks in the short videos. Are they helpful?
Henry Chamberlain, experienced industrial psychologist and internationally accredited executive coach.
Henry's vision is to transform coaching in Asia and beyond and to create a world where everyone has access to a coach.
Trauma has a negative connotation, do you think?
Absolutely. I've avoided trauma work. My friends have said, Henry, the work that you do is absolutely related to trauma. And I say, no, I'm not traumatized. And my clients are not traumatized. Why should I go there? And I literally resisted it for 4 or 5 years, saying, it's got nothing to do with me. And the moment I read the first book or the first work indirectly about trauma, I realized it has everything to do with what we do.
Are you worried about the world and where we're heading?
When I started the coaching work, I wanted to change the world. And I realized that...
Someone once said to me, aim for the moon. And even if I don't make it, I might end up amongst the stars. 4.5 years ago, I got stuck. I made it my mission to spread positivity and help 1 million people to think differently. If you also believe that our world needs more positive energy, please join us on the journey. I'm Aaron Pang, and this is a Transformative Purpose.
Henry, welcome to the TP Podcast.
Thanks, Aaron. Nice to be here.
Nice. Likewise. We're here to talk about coaching.
Yes.
I understand that you coach a lot of coaches.
Coaching everything, coaching all things coaching. That's my great passion. Yes. Yeah. So I'm really excited to talk about that.
Does everyone need a coach?
Everybody needs a coach. And about 2 years ago, I got into a taxi and the driver asked me, what do you do? And I explained to him and he says, I also want a coach. And I think my slogan came from there, or a slogan came from there, like everybody needs a coach. I'm sure you're going to ask more questions around that, but that's the fundamental assumption.
And how did you get into coaching?
Well, that's a long story. It's the least likely place where I could have ended up. I'm a trained psychologist, an occupational psychologist, and I've always done behavioral work. But once I started learning coaching skills, I thought, this is so sacred. This is so special. I never want to do this for a living. If you run after money for this, or if it becomes a money-driven thing, it will lose its power. It will lose its magic. And strangely enough, over the last 15 years, that's exactly where I ended up. It's the part of my business that kept on growing without marketing, without sales, without any work. It was just growing by itself. So I actually ended up there by accident, if you want to say it that way. But I felt like I was born to do this work. The more I do it, the deeper I go, the more powerful transformations I see, I experience. I don't want to do anything else at this moment.
So you're born to do this work.
I feel it's my life calling. I'm really on purpose when I do the type of coaching work that I do with individuals and teams and organizations. And it's evolved over time. So it's not just one-on-one coaching, but it's behavioral strategies. Yeah.
How did you feel about this statement? There are two important days. The first one is the day that we're born, and the second day is the day that we realize why we're here.
It touches me at a very deep level. I think it's absolutely true, and I think it's absolutely underrated. And it falls into that bucket of stuff that people think are the soft stuff that actually is the hard stuff that drives sustainable performance, sustainable behavior over time. And that makes us truly happy. I couldn't agree more.
What's the soft stuff, and how would you define coaching? What is coaching? Let's unpack that.
Yeah, I will get in trouble if I go down that route, but let me try. I think there's, for as many people as you ask, there would be different coaching definitions. There are textbook definitions, but they all differ quite a lot. I think the one thing that makes coaching different from other things that's easily taken apart, or you can easily tease it apart, is that it's not telling people what to do. That's almost the only common thing across all of the definitions. So it's non-directive, it's not telling people what to do, it's helping people to come to their own solutions. And there's multiple ways to get there, and there's people saying, well, it's an intelligent conversation, it's helping people to uncover their own answers, it's helping people connect with themselves. But I think if you They all have slight different opinions, but they come down to what is it that you want, and connecting to yourself and finding your own answers without the inputs and the guidance and the direction of the coach.
I had a conversation with another executive coach. His name is Matt Ling. I believe you also know him too. We had this long dialogue about what makes up a good coach and how do we spot the not very effective ones. right? So you mentioned about being a coach, we're not supposed to solve people's problems. People who go into coaching, do they also have the same expectation, or are they looking for answers?
You're digging a deep hole for me. so I'll hedge my bets. I'll step back. It's a well-known fact that people studying psychology do it more for themselves than for really helping other people. Oh, it's a well-known assumption out there. And I think coaches are no different. Many people going into coaching actually want to solve their own problems, and they do it by trying to fix other people's problems. That's the brutal truth of many people. There are amazing coaches out there, and there are people who do fantastic transformative work. But I think there's an element of we bring our own questions and we project our own questions onto coaches. Therefore, you will find that you attract certain types of people who always come your way. And coaches seem to have the same solutions for whatever the coachee shows up with. I think it starts with a coach. And it starts with the fact that many people have more of an unawareness of what they really bring into coaching. And that's something that's really important in coach training as they develop.
There are many different types of coaches. The ones that I've come across with, they are relationship coaches, executive coaches, which are more prominent sort of in a work context. And then there's marriage coaches, relationship coaches, health coaches. So you mentioned everyone needs a coach, right?
Yes.
Does everyone need the life coach, or do they need something more specific, or does it depend on what sort of context or issues that they're facing?
I think if we put labels on it, it helps us as coaches to identify ourselves and to brand ourselves. But that also causes people to put a coach in a box. And I identify myself as a coach, full stop. Some people say the work I do is more life coaching than executive coaching. I disagree. If I coach the CEO of a big company to find his meaning or purpose, is that life coaching or is that executive coaching? So we get lost in the language. I think everybody needs a coach, and every coach needs to be able to help their clients with fundamental life skills in addition to the things that they want to specialize in.
Mm. So you study psychology and you just mentioned labels. Yeah. How do you see labels?
They become self-fulfilling prophecies. They are very helpful to help us to understand the world and to classify the world. It's a normal thing for our brains to put labels on stuff because then we don't have to think. Then we don't have to think about a healthy breakfast or an unhealthy breakfast. It reduces thinking time and it simplifies life. But at the same time, we don't question our labels. And then we start acting according to our labels and also to the labels we put on people. Mm. And that complicates life, obviously, once we need to. If everything works perfectly, then things run well. But the moment you need to stop, you need to think, you need to change, there's a ton of these unconscious. They go to the unconscious level, and then we don't become aware of them, and they drive our behavior. And we need to go back and to re-script those labels or beliefs or remove them if we want to create this type of change that many of us are facing in life today.
How does somebody become more self-aware of the labels that others have imposed on them, or they have imposed their own labels on themselves?
I think if I have to give a simple answer to that, most of us will benefit from slowing down. Mm. A famous coach was approached by somebody saying, I want to do a better presentation. And the coach said, well, go and notice what you do before you do a bad presentation. And he walked away. And it's almost as simple as that. Frustratingly simple is if you want to become self-aware, stop and reflect and turn inwards. There's not a magic pill that does that. You will have to do the first step to stop and to slow down. And a lot of the work that I do is to help people to slow down the motion, the beliefs, the assumptions, the stories they tell themselves. And once you slow down the motion, it's often glaringly obvious what's going on and what you need to do or where you are stuck. And you understand stuck, so I'll stay out of stuckness. That's something that you really know much more about me than me.
Mm. I wouldn't say that. I would say I'm still a work in progress. I'm still learning. But I think one of the things that I've benefited me a lot is definitely slowing down, putting more boundaries in terms of how I spend time, how I want to use my time. And it goes back to what you were saying earlier. I think it's all about intention.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that I learned in the last few years is that technology plays a big role in accelerating the pace of living for me.
Yes.
And as soon as I started all these small incremental things, just like setting notification summary, for example, instead of letting notifications get to me 24/7, I use notification summary and I sort of block those unnecessary distractions 3 times a day, 5 times a day. But it takes a lot of practice and discipline. And it's so easy to fall back into your old self.
I think I love all of the things that technology brings us. It gives me a vastly different and a vastly improved life. But we must acknowledge, I think as a starting point of coaching, of wellness, well-being, of mastery, is we live in a world that's not designed to have our well-being in mind. Technology, I was shocked to see some of the interviews with technology people who quit the social media industry, who said, I've got a PhD in mathematics and my only job is to make people click on things. So there are people with vast brains and huge intellectual powers who are occupied on a daily basis to make us stick to our screens, look at our screens longer and click on stuff. They don't have our well-being in mind. And if you're doing if you're facing a complicated situation or a complicated enemy, you need a more complicated and a more sophisticated strategy.
Mm. I want to ask this question to you, a thoughtful coach. Are you worried about the world and where we're heading?
There's a part of me that worries about the world when I look at it. When I slow down and I calm, I also don't worry. That might be a conflicting answer, but that's part of my coaching approach, is to realize that we have different parts of ourselves. There's different me's or different selves living inside of myself. So I have an anxious bit that says, oh my goodness, the world looks really out of control. And there's another part of me, and I think the majority of me, that says things will happen exactly as they should. And when I connect with that part, I'm grounded, I'm calm, and that panic that comes from my less calm part stops flooding me. And I can make decisions from the place of calm and the place of self.
Yeah. And what do you do, or what should people do when their inner dialogues are in conflict with each other, just like how you put it?
That's the topic of PhDs and, and advanced and long-term coaching. But I think the fundamental thing that I have discovered and that really changed my life and changed the life of many of my coaches is that we have different voices in our head. And you are not crazy. We actually have multiple personalities. Sometimes people call it sub-personalities. And the first step is just to acknowledge that you have them and to not run away from it. And you're not broken if you feel that way. The next steps are then, there's various approaches and various ways, is slow down, notice them, acknowledge them. And there's various steps in which you can manage them to ultimately befriend them and integrate them into your life.
And how do you slow down as a coach? And how do you advise other people to slow down?
I'm still a work in progress, but there's two things that have been really powerful for me. It's basic mindfulness practice. And I literally started 15 years ago not being able to do 2 minutes of mindfulness in the morning. I now have reached the point where when I do my retreats, I can do 90 minutes at a time and without dying. And I also do 2-day silent retreats where I engage in longer term mindfulness. But you don't need to do that. You don't need to be a Jedi master. It's as little as 5 minutes a day can really build a mindfulness practice. The other thing that I've discovered more recently is using breathing to induce mindfulness and to center yourself. And I've totally underestimated that for the vast majority of my life. So combining mindfulness with mindful breathing is a sure win. It's almost calmness reflection 101.
How do you do mindful breathing?
There are multiple ways to do it. So normally if you learn mindfulness, people say focus on your breath. There would be many mindfulness techniques that says focus on your breath, notice how it feels, where it goes, etc., etc. So I'm not going to repeat known things. So that's a starting point, is noticing your breath instead of the weather outside, what's in your head, etc. The breathing part is to breathe consciously and to do diaphragmatic breathing. So that in its simplest form is 4 seconds in, 4 seconds out, breathing into your belly instead of into your chest, because that triggers a lot of emotional stuff. Slowing down your breath consciously to 4 breaths in, 4 breaths out, that's been taught by warriors, the US Marines, or executives, sports people all over the world. So by practicing that conscious breathing. And that takes a bit of breathing muscle or muscle memory. So you would practice it just like you would practice mindfulness so that you can be calm and breathe in a calm and a relaxed manner when you most need it.
So you mentioned you got into breathing, mindful breathing, 15 years ago. Who was Henry then? And who is Henry now? How did you find your calling?
I found my calling much earlier than that, but I was still a really rough and inconsistent tool. So I had deep insights. I could read people's behavior really well. And under the right conditions, I could really help them do profound things. I've discovered that early in my life, that that's a gift that I have. But I failed to pay attention to myself. I'm a neurotic personality. That's a label. I own that. And it just means that my brain is wired in different ways to be much more emotionally reactive. So my joy is much more intense than other people's joys. My depression is much more depressing than other people's depression. And that's not a life sentence or a death sentence, but it means that I need to have extra mindfulness. I need to practice extra breathing, and I need to take other precautions, food, dietary, lifestyle, so that I can optimally play with that situation the way my brain is wired. So over the last 15 years, it's been a process of cleaning up, going inwards, doing less, but doing more, spending more time reflecting, becoming more mindful, making friends with the parts that I've been running away from. So I've been a masterful coach of other people's emotions, but I discovered that I actually don't like feeling my own emotions. Mm. So the last 7 years specifically has been a deep journey into accessing some of my inaccessible emotions and allowing them and being comfortable feeling what I really feel.
Yeah. And how do you do that?
I think primarily it started through 15 years ago, I did not do mindful breathing. I just started with basic mindfulness. Mm. I've added the breath work in the last 2 years. It's intention. I think we're going to repeat ourselves quite a lot here. It's starting with the intention and say, I don't want to continue living like this. I'm not happy with the outcomes that I'm getting. Unfortunately, as with many other people, sometimes we have to face some adversity before we listen and before we take decisions in our own interest. So I had some adversity. I had some challenges both at work, in my relationships, in my personal life that caused me to stop and slow down and to reflect and say, what is it that you really want and who is it that you really want to be? How do you want to show up in these situations? And I was fortunate enough that from my profession, I was surrounded by coaches, psychologists, counselors, therapists who gave me huge insights. But ultimately, I had to come to that point where I said, I'm not happy with the way things working at the moment for me, and I'd like to do that differently.
I was listening to how you define, you said you're a neurotic person. Yeah. And when you're joyful, you're more happy.
Yes.
Relative to other people. When you're sad, you're more sad than the majority of population. The definition resonated a lot when I was listening to what you were saying. How do you tell whether someone is neurotic?
I'm running down a rabbit hole. I think there's some simple questions that you can ask yourself. There's some personality assessments that measures it. I wrote an article on LinkedIn a while ago, so maybe I'll find that link and you can post it with a podcast if people would like to read, because I started exploring that in an initial level. I never went much deeper than it is. So firstly, if you do some personality assessments, I know some of the big five personality assessments measure neuroticism, or they call it emotionality. It's a much better label, still a label. The second thing is you can just ask yourself, am I experiencing more intense emotions than other people? And you won't notice it until people tell you, your wife, husband, partner, girlfriend, boyfriend, parents. Or sometimes if you just reflect and you slow down, you will notice that I am quite emotionally erratic or intense. And people tell me that I'm very intense. So there are ways, simple questions that you can ask to see, do I react like that? And that can guide you, and you can get a more scientific answer if you really want that.
So is now your normal self?
I'm in a much more... when we started this morning, I was quite excited and slightly nervous. So I still feel all of those feelings. But at this place, yes, I don't feel triggered. I don't feel that my emotions are leading me. I feel a lot more grounded in the moment right here.
Mm. I want to ask you about this thinking or perspective, still related to labeling. Sometimes I feel like the labels that the society has created sort of freak us out a bit, right? We have labels such as trauma, right? We have labels such as anxiety, depression. I had a lot of negative emotions 4.5 years ago based off on a life lesson. But to this date, I refuse to label them.
Okay.
Because I think, and I kind of want to get your opinion on this too, is I think that there is just emotion, and then there is our choice, what meaning we want to give to those emotions. They could be positive or negative depending on what lens we are looking at them. And I try to avoid just labeling, just making shortcuts by saying, hey, I had a trauma, my son suffocated, I had debt guilt, I had anxiety. Even though when I reflected, a lot of the behaviors weren't desirable, I would say, and a lot of feelings actually drove irrational behaviors. I didn't have a good night's sleep for a long period of time, and I hadn't noticed how much it was impacting me until I started to put pen to paper, right? Almost put down all my thoughts, all my emotions down on a piece of paper, and I couldn't have felt better. That was probably one of the best decisions that I've accidentally, I think, discovered in the last 4.5 years. Does journaling help? Does writing help? What's your take on it?
I want to start at the beginning of the conversation, but the short answer is journaling absolutely helps. And journaling is one of the steps of slowing down. It's that first step of becoming aware. Is journaling is immensely powerful. It's another rabbit hole to label emotions. The fact is that most of the problems I experience and that I've seen people experience is not feeling emotions. It's not whether they're positive or negative. It's not being able to feel what you really feel. And then irrational behavior becomes very often a reaction to an emotion. Our secondary pain is worse than our primary pain. I don't want to feel like this. And if we then say, well, I don't want to label emotions or I don't want to feel it, then you build emotions on top of emotions. And that's very often the bigger problem. So there's the famous story of people who stop smoking and gain weight. So I smoke to help me be more calm, but my smoking causes me lung cancer. So ultimately, sustainable solutions is to be able to connect, to feel the feelings that you're feeling, positive or negative, and then not to react in a reactive manner to that, but to say, I feel this, I acknowledge this, I can tolerate this, but who is it that I want to be in this situation? And that's the work of my life. I've improved a lot in 15 years. And if you ask me, the difference between me and myself 15 years ago is much less reactive, much less erratic, and much more able to take the low road, as they refer to in emotional intelligence. But it's a work in progress. And I still have a lot of potholes and a lot of things that can trigger me. But it's that less triggering. And then back to the answer is journaling helps. But there's also things, labels in terms of trauma, that I think that psychology has done us a disservice by labeling things as trauma. I don't know if you want to go there, but I think it's an unidentified thing that if we understand what it is, can make our lives immensely better and avoid us avoiding things or mislabeling things.
No, I love to go deeper on trauma. Trauma has a negative connotation, do you think?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I've avoided trauma work. My friends have said, Henry, the work that you do is absolutely related to trauma. And I say, no, I'm not traumatized. And my clients are not traumatized. Why should I go there? And I literally resisted it for 4 or 5 years, saying, it's got nothing to do with me. And the moment I read the first book or the first work indirectly about trauma, I realized it has everything to do with what we do. So I want to redefine. So if I can
please
do it, I've unsuccessfully tried to publish something on that, and my head just doesn't want to get it nailed down. So this is an opportunity to test it. The textbook definition or the root definition of trauma is anything that exceeds your capability or your capacity to cope. And that there's big T traumas, like you witness a parent die or you are in a car accident. And there's small T trauma. And the most underestimated sources of trauma is the small T trauma. Imagine that you're 2 years old and your parents are nowhere to be found. You walk around the house and suddenly there's nobody there. That would exceed your trauma or your capacity to cope, and that counts as trauma. And the facts are that your mind, our constitution, whatever you want to call yourself, takes that traumatic situation, puts it in, records it, and keeps it for all of your life, and it keeps on affecting your behavior at later life. So the bigger the trauma, the more repeated it is, the more it affects the way that you act. So if you look at it that way, then your whole life, even the best parents, even the best upbringing, has had some things that exceeded your capacity to cope. It caused you to record that and then to build a defensive mechanism around that. Now I act differently based on that. I will never let my parents out of my sight. And that, as a repercussion, if you don't review that, it continues into adult life until you die. And part of my work is helping people to go back and say, what are the stories? What are the defensive mechanisms and the narratives that you wrote based on things that are no longer relevant in your life? Sorry, that's a long answer to...
No, I love it. Thank you. So what do you do when someone comes to you and say, hey, Henry, I have a trauma, help me?
I don't have anybody doing that. So that's part of my work is people say, I want to be a better leader. I want to be more visionary. I want to be more strategic. Or I just want to improve my time management. Traumas often come masked as very innocent things showing up. So I've got very senior executives who are willing to pay executive coaching rates for time management. And that normally triggers my trauma alarm. Say, if you, the reality is that time management is a one-page solution. You can read it in any book. You can watch one video and time management can be, I don't want to insult the time management gurus, but if you're an executive running a big organization, it's not something that you need to spend years and years and years studying. It's a solvable problem. When I then start unpacking, say, why don't you manage your time? Where is it that you're struggling? It often comes up that people have an inner critic that says you must keep on working all the time. You're never enough. You're never good enough. They have an inner pleaser that says, I need to do what other people say. If my client calls me at 2 a.m. in the morning, the narrative is, I have no choice. And if you start listening to people's stories, the famous coach David Drake said, if you understand the stories people tell themselves, everybody's behavior makes sense. And that's the level at which I engage normally with my clients. It looks like an innocent time management problem, but it often has deeper roots that goes quite deep. And depending on what you want to do, you can do some behavioral overrides, or you can start going to the root and rewrite that story that drives that behavior.
So time management becomes a solution to a symptom rather than the underlying root cause. I think that's what you're saying.
Absolutely. So it's an absolutely legitimate solution. And then when we talk about coach training, is that most coaching training is designed to solve problems at the behavioral level. You have a time management problem. Let's set some goals. Let's have some action plans. And let's do some time management methodology. That's perfect. And coaching was designed to fill that gap in the market, not filled by teaching, not by consulting, and not by psychology. But now, if your coachee has a childhood trauma that makes him, and now we say trauma, if your coachee learned that I must please mummy and daddy in order to be happy, that story drives their adult behavior. And no amount of habits, discipline, rules, regulations, all of those things would fix it. You just suppress it and it comes out in other ways. And if your problem was simply a time management problem, fine. If not, that's normally where people end up with me and we start unpacking the things. Do some good time management in addition, but then go and find the root cause.
Yeah. Sometimes when I talk to people, it can be a scary experience. Unpacking the wounds.
Yes.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of courage.
So as people are unpacking their wounds, and I think, I don't know whether you agree with this, and I think this whole coaching / self-development industry is very fragmented, right? Yes. And so people really got to be mindful and careful about who they are opening up to.
Yes.
Right? Any advice there?
Well, fragmented, that links very back to the labels. So if I have an eating problem, I go and see a diet coach. If I have a relationship problem, I need to see a relationship coach. And I'm fortunate in the point that not for all of them, but for many of my clients, I help them with relationship coaching. I help them with lifestyle coaching as well as the executive coaching, because if you follow the underlying principles and you find where people are stuck or what the root causes is, it's the same things that we've just discussed. So in terms of the fragmentedness, I'm amazed, and I train coaches and I evaluate coaches and I supervise coaches. I'm still amazed at the level of capability required to pass a minimal international certification. And I'm not trying to diss any of the international standards. It's really, really low to get over the first bar of being an internationally certified coach. So when you open up to somebody, I think you need a lot more than just a credential. And you need to know that the person that you're going to open up to will be able to contain, not put their own issues there and tell you that you should be different or look at it through their distorted lens, and that they would really have your well-being at heart. And that's a huge statement. All of those elements, I realize each of them needs a lot of qualification, but that's the essence. You can easily open up to somebody who does not have the skill or the will or the motivation to help you to really achieve what you need to achieve to address your issue.
Mm. So what other information should people look for other than, you know, the formal certification?
I think formal certification is an entry ticket. You should not hire a coach that does not have a formal certification. That's just a thing that professionals do. As a professional psychologist, I join the Psychological Society. As a coach, I train, I join a coaching group or a coaching professional body. Thereafter, you need to, I think it's firstly the psychological safety that you feel with a person. Almost every coach now does chemistry meetings. So you would want to use a chemistry session to see how do you work, how do you approach me, what would it feel like to be coached by you. And I try and do my chemistry sessions in a way that my clients would have an experience of what it would be like being coached by me. So I make it as realistic as possible. I do some of the methodologies, but it's also an opportunity for them to ask me, to feel, to see, to challenge. So I think that chemistry meeting is a magical opportunity to judge whether you feel safe with that person. Then depending on the work that you do, what's this person's background? If you're going to do deep psychological work, would you like to have a freshly graduated coach? Would you like to have somebody who's done their own work? And that's probably step number two, is tell me about your own journey. Tell me about your self-work that brought you to this place. I would like to feel that my coach on the other side does not just have theoretical knowledge or watch one video on YouTube about deep coaching. I would want to know that they are on the path, or that they've walked the path themselves. So those are some of the things just to start out with, in addition to credentials and bio, the data that you get on the bio.
Yeah. I recently read, I'm reading the Diary of a CEO, and in one of the studies, he quoted the average attention span has dropped from 10 seconds to 8 seconds, which is less than a goldfish. Apparently, goldfish has about 9 seconds of attention span. And you touch on videos, this 1 minute video. And there are a lot of advices, people giving advices, doing different hooks in the short videos. Are they helpful?
Yes. But we need to have horses for courses. I think that there's a lot of common knowledge that's not so common. That I've learned a lot of hacks on YouTube. I like doing woodwork. And I learned a lot of things on YouTube that would have taken me years as an apprentice to learn. But hacks, I differentiate between hacks and knacks. A knack is something that needs practice, that needs repetition, that needs mastery, and that needs work. And you don't learn knacks by just watching a quick video. So in a sense, yes, there are some quick fixes, but we are running after. I find clients run into problems and they end up working with me because they have tried all the quick fixes. And the quick fixes make things worse. We create secondary problems like the smoking and eating. I now eat less, but I get lung cancer. And these things become intertwined. So we have to be careful. The world is most behavioral solutions. And sustaining behavioral change is not a hack process. It's a method. It should be something based on authenticity, based on slowing down, based on connecting to yourself, rather than a quick fix out there. That doesn't say that quick fixes aren't important. Sometimes we just need a quick fix to solve. We don't have to go to our childhood to figure out how to plan our day.
One of my favorite books, Think Again, from Adam Grant. I don't know if you read it, but in this book, he advocates people should think more like a scientist. We should look for cues where how we could be wrong. So I wanted to ask you, and this is also a topic where it is very close to my heart, because I work in the digital industry for close to 18 years. I've seen all the solutions and all the problems technologies come with. As a coach, and we talked about slowing down, being intentional, we talked about mindfulness, mindful breathing. How can we get people to slow down when so many of them are addicted to the mobile phone, and we have social engineers behind these companies just getting people hooked on using the phone for as long as possible? Is there a solution? What would be Henry's solution?
That sparks a lot. Let me see where I want to engage with that. When I started the coaching work, I wanted to change the world. And I realized that I cannot. I had a very personal experience that when I started my business, I was walking up the mountain and I was hiking. And all of a sudden, I heard a voice, and I'm very cautious to say this in public. People may misinterpret it, but I heard a voice in my head. It was clearly in my head that says, take care of yourself and your business will take care of itself. And I spent the next 10 years ignoring that advice. And I was not ready to listen to that advice. But through the process that I've shared, some personal relationship, business challenges, I was forced to face myself. And I had to slow down. And I had to start looking at that. For most people, that's the way it works. You lose a loved one, you lose a limb, you get sick, you lose your health. But it is possible to slow down if we start creating more awareness. But it's not a quick fix. The majority of people are addicted to their phones, to their social media. And for me, it's not to say I need a campaign to fight the demon. It's to say, am I ready? Am I in the right place? And is my life a testament to living a life that's not addicted to those things? And then next is, how do I educate? And one of my passions is making coaching available to everybody and making these life skills available to everybody on a sustainable basis. So I'm a businessman, I can't do it for free all the time, but is there a way in which we don't have to charge exorbitant coaching rates for CEOs, but we can make it available for people? So I think every coach also has a responsibility to do some education and to see how we can do some work in our communities and with people around us to lay the fundamental foundations. The other part, sorry, is we should start thinking like scientists.
Think like that?
We are functionally blind. We are functionally blind. As a coach and a psychologist, I did not see my own black spots. I did not see my own blind spots for the best part of 5 decades. Yes, it's absolutely important to think like a scientist, but you would set yourself up for failure if you think you're just going to change your thinking and be there. Therefore, counselors, coaches, therapists, and then in a corporate environment, feedback. I give feedback to people about their ineffective leadership behaviors at the age of 50 or 60, and they say, why didn't anybody tell me this earlier? So I think they just didn't listen to the feedback earlier, or maybe people were scared of them. But the fact is, seeing your own behavior and thinking about thinking is a much harder skill than people make out to be. And that's why we need these tools. I use psychological assessments. I use 360-degree assessments. And I use data collection methods to help people to see the reality more clearly. And the good news is you can learn it. But don't think that you're going to see your blind spots by just deciding, I want to see my blind spots.
What a beautiful answer. Our purpose is to spread positivity,
yeah,
right? And I believe we have a mutual passion, which is why we're here. How can we do more of that? And how do you see positivity more importantly?
I think positivity is an outcome for me. I pursue positivity through fulfillment. If we do the right things for the right reasons, we will be fulfilled. And we will experience more positivity. Unfortunately, our brains, our bodies are not wired for happiness. There's very clear research that we are hardwired to look for things to go wrong. We are still evolutionary-wise a million years behind. So we are hardwired to look for mistakes, to look for things going wrong, to fear the next thing. So this is absolutely normal. And there's a great book called The Happiness Trap. That's one of the textbooks of my life that actually says, by trying to be happy and questioning why am I not happy is a bit a black rabbit hole that's going to suck all the energy out of you. So acknowledging that we are not wired for happiness, but we can be, and we can be fulfilled, for me, that's the most important thing. To help people to find their purpose and to find meaning in life. And I think the day, discovering the day why you were born, is for me one of the biggest pursuits in my life. And it was one of the biggest days in my life, is realizing what's my purpose and being able to do to pursue that with meaning. And I know I know this is like for people who are not in this space, they may think it's woo-woo, it's too soft, it's those funny things, but there's great power in finding those things in your life.
I was going to wrap up this conversation, but what you just share sparked another thought in my head. How do you see happiness and fulfillment?
That's a good, how can I do that in a concise way? I would try and explain fulfillment through a sense of meaning. And many people ask, what's the meaning of life? And my answer is, I've tried to pursue many of these answers. My answer is there's no meaning to life. If you're a spiritual guru, maybe you feel differently about that way. But for the normal lay person on the street, if you are asking what's the meaning of life, it will absolutely drive you crazy, because there's wars, there's bad people, good people die. But the answer that gave me the first foundational step of stability is, meaning is when you do things that where you apply what you are best at towards something that you value. And that means you must understand your strength, you must accept and embrace who you are and what you're good at, and you must know what's most important to you in life, your personal values. And if you combine those things, then life is meaningful to you. It may not be meaningful in general. And I find that when I do that, that brings me great happiness. But happiness is an emotion. Happiness is an indication that you are feeling good. Life can be really good and you can be unhappy. So differentiating between a feeling good and being really good. I think that would be, for me, inside, the shortest way I can get there.
Yeah, I love it. Thank you. Fascinating. I personally feel that people should stop pursuing happiness, because like you said, it's just an emotion, like sadness, like depression, like anxiety. People should pursue fulfillment.
Yeah.
Right? Because fulfillment is lifelong, right? Whereas happiness, just like any other emotion, is temporary.
The moment you finish eating that ice cream, the happiness is gone. Or the moment you get your bonus, I think there's ample evidence, is you get that promotion and a month later, you are unhappy again. So we are wired to be unhappy, and it's okay. You will be happy if you pursue the other things. That's the good news for me.
One question you want to ask the next guest.
What makes your life meaningful? What brings you joy and meaning and a sense of purpose in your life?
Thank you so much, Henry. I learned a ton today.
Fantastic.
And looking forward to seeing more impact, you know, from the coaches that you help nurture.
Thank you. It was a fantastic conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Cheers.
Thanks, everyone.